This week on Capitalism, Race and Democracy.
If you ever needed proof about how Israel is manipulating global media to peddle its propaganda in the guise of anti-Semitism and Holocaust, this is it.
After Israeli soccer fans instigate violent clashes in Amsterdam, Western leaders and media defend the hooligans as innocent victims of anti-Semitism.
We need to assist the Congolese in their fight against Western capitalism. They're fighting literally for their lives.
Western-based transnational corporations are spearheading and funding war and genocide against the Congo's indigenous populations.
Many of the sort of more persistent problems that people were reporting in East Palestine are a fit to what was seen, for instance, with Gulf War veterans.
The chemical contamination of East Palestine has resulted in health problems for residents and workers that are similar to those of Gulf War veterans and victims of 9/11.
And in every period of American history, when Black people fight for rights, civil and economic rights, the quality of life for white people goes up.
Journalist Roland Martin says Senator Bernie Sanders did not address white voters and the issue of race in his response to the 2024 presidential election results. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. After Israeli soccer fans instigated violent clashes in Amsterdam on November 7th, Western leaders and media swiftly defended the hooligans as innocent victims of anti-Semitism. Pacifica's Paulina Basilio has more.
5 people were injured and 62 were arrested in the capital of the Netherlands on November 7th when supporters of Israel's Maccabi Tel Aviv soccer team confronted pro-Palestinian demonstrators following a Europa League match. The clashes erupted in response to provocations from the Maccabi side. Video footage showed Maccabi fans chanting inflammatory slogans such as "Kill the Arabs" and "There are no schools in Gaza because all the children are dead." Such declarations are considered incitement to genocide, a criminal act under international law. The Israeli fans also interrupted a minute of silence for flood victims in Valencia, Spain, by igniting fireworks. Spain has expressed support for a Palestinian state and has taken steps to curtail arms shipments to Israel. The Jerusalem Post and other outlets reported that Israeli Mossad agents were accompanying the soccer delegation. Meanwhile, U.S., Israeli, Dutch, and European leaders condemned the clashes as anti-Semitic. U.S. President Joe Biden called the clashes despicable, asserting that they, quote, echo dark moments in history when Jews were persecuted. UK's Sky News media platform published a report in which it did not attempt to whitewash the pro-Zionist hooligans, but swiftly deleted it. Independent journalist Rifat Jawaid shared the deleted video on his YouTube channel, Janta Ka Reporter.
Violence in Amsterdam left at least 5 people injured and dozens have been arrested. But what happened? Supporters of Israeli football club Maccabi Tel Aviv arrived in Amsterdam ahead of their UEFA Europa League match against Amsterdam club Ajax. On Wednesday, social media videos verified by Sky News show Maccabi Tel Aviv fans tearing down Palestinian flags from outside of homes. Other social media videos appeared to show residents chasing Maccabi Tel Aviv fans. On Thursday, just before the game, crowds of Maccabi fans were filmed singing racist and anti-Arab songs. While a pro-Palestinian demonstration had been banned by the mayor over fears there would be clashes. Later that evening, during the match, Israeli supporters appeared to disrupt the minute silence for Valencia flood victims with chants, whistles and fireworks. Maccabi fans were seen attacking locals as a police car can be seen driving by. People with Palestinian flags were seen marching on the streets. Maccabi supporters say they were beaten and attacked on the streets of the Dutch capital, with videos showing some of the violence.
Say free Palestine and we go. Good.
Sky News could not independently verify all of the footage shown. Police arrested 62 people. 5 were taken to hospital, but have since been discharged. Israeli far-right ultras are notorious for their racism and physical violence. Dutch, Israeli and British leaders denounced the attacks as anti-Semitic and even referred to it as a pogrom. But their statements failed to mention the assaults by the Israeli hooligans against Dutch citizens.
That was a deleted Sky News report on the Amsterdam incident. Sky News swiftly published an edited version of the video to remove the blame from the Israelis. Journalist Rifat Jawaid explains.
Part of the Israeli propaganda toolkit is to play the anti-Semitism card in spite of all its crimes. It was evident in the edited version of the Sky News video. Within seconds of the video, Sky News had added an unrelated clip of the Dutch Prime Minister invoking anti-Semitism. It then removed the portion where Alice Porter has said how residents attacked Israeli criminals. This was replaced with a reference to Free Palestine Movement. The portion where Alice had explicitly blamed Maccabi supporters for chasing and attacking people in Amsterdam was replaced by a large group of hooded men dressed in black. The mention of Maccabi fans had gone. The new video had detailed information on a pro-Palestinian protest in Amsterdam, even though the video did not say how this was relevant, except to imply that Israelis were targeted because of the goings-on in Gaza, and this was not in retaliation to Israeli criminals' act of hooliganism. If this wasn't enough, Sky News found a really traumatized Israeli. Israelis are always traumatized, even when they kill thousands of Palestinian babies. So it may not have been difficult for Sky News to find a traumatized Israeli. This traumatized Israeli explicitly linked the development to 7th of October attacks, a date when the humanity began, according to Israel and its slaves in the Western world.
Maccabi supporters say they were beaten and attacked on the streets of the Dutch capital.
It's the same feeling that I felt in the morning of the 7th of October.
Sky News could not independently verify all of the footage shown. 62 people have been arrested, and prosecutors are considering anti-Semitic motives. 5 people were also taken to hospital, but have since been discharged. Dutch and Israeli leaders denounced the attacks as anti-Semitic and even referred to it as a pogrom.
So Sky News has done it again. If you ever needed an example of broad daylight fraud on the collective conscience of the news-consuming British public, this is it. If you also ever needed proof about how Israel is manipulating global media to peddle its propaganda in the guise of anti-Semitism and Holocaust, this is it. If you ever needed an evidence how the so-called established media platforms are ready to crawl even when they are only being asked to bend, this is it.
That was Rifat Jawaid on his YouTube channel, Jantaka Reporter. Special thanks to Freddy Libertad, who contributed to the production of this report. For Capitalism, Race and Democracy, I'm Paulina Vasiliev.
This is a message to the sour and the powerful. Our crew will never bow down to you like cowards do. All we know, reach towards the sun like the flowers do. When they snatch his life, I wonder the truth Malcolm knew. You care about celebrities, and every time their bowels move, we care about the enemy, and watch the way their falcons zoom. And a war is overkill, like an album with 1,000 tunes. Now the news won't tell you the truth about our views. For children of the camps, searching for electricity, constantly waiting for a destiny that they didn't see. I know I can't change the world with the next simile, but I can paint a vivid picture of the next victory. The soul lives on, even when you're dead physically. I wrote this song to lyrically end the trilogy. It won't be long, let me spell it explicitly. My voice will not die, even if they imprison me. I said the album's been in the making a quarter century. Over a decade later, I've still got the same energy, same insane enemies. It seems the pain never leaves. After Grenfell Burn was never the same mentally. Never for the fashion tags and massive ads. This is for political prisoners, feeling trapped and sad. Not for the rapper pulling up in a flashy Jag. It's for the person on the same street, wrapped in rags. It's for the dad carrying.
That was music by Low Key, soundtrack to The Struggle 3. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race and Democracy. I'm Akul Holt. Next, Block Report's DR Balray recently spoke to Milton Alamadi about Uganda's involvement in the Western-backed genocide in the Congo. Alamadi is the founder and executive editor of the Black Star News, the deputy managing editor of the City Sun in Brooklyn, an adjunct professor at the City College of New York, and a PhD candidate at Howard University.
I have you on here to talk a little bit about the relationship that the nation of Uganda, specifically under the regime of Museveni. Can you tell the people what impact has Uganda had on the genocide in the Congo?
Okay, very good. Thank you for that question. Museveni, General Yoweri Museveni, who has ruled Uganda for 38 years now with U.S. support, just as it's the U.S. had supported a puppet in the Congo throughout the 1960s until he was deposed in 1997. And that was General Mobutu, the notorious Mobutu, who killed Patrice Lumumba on behalf of imperialism in 1961, overthrew him in 1960 and killed him in 1961. And he was a reliable puppet and agent of imperialism in East and Central Africa, doing the bidding. Whenever imperialism wanted to intervene somewhere and needed a collaborator, Mobutu would be willing to provide Congolese troops and betray other Africans. So Museveni has been playing that role for 38 years. And part of the calamity that we see now in Congo, Museveni is directly responsible for that. Because in 1990, Museveni sponsored an invasion of Rwanda in 1990. People don't talk about that often because it's an inconvenient truth, because Museveni was backed by the United States, so he invaded Rwanda in 1990. That exacerbated ethnic tension between Hutu majority and the Tutsi community, which is the minority community in Rwanda. And then when the plane carrying the Hutu president of Rwanda was shot down in 1994, that immediately then ignited that Holocaust in Rwanda, which eventually spread to the Congo. So Museveni is directly responsible for the genocide in both Rwanda as well as in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which continues up today as we speak.
What kind of impact has Uganda playing a part in the genocide in the Congo had on Ugandan society, Ugandan politics, and the national economy in Uganda?
Okay, that once again is a very, very good question. It has, of course, meant that Uganda has suffered under a repressive regime for 38 years. So Uganda holds sham elections every 5 years. The outcome is decided by Museveni himself. He handpicks what is called an independent election commission. It's a very cynical name because he is the one that selects the members of this commission. And that commission then declares who won the elections. It is very clear that he was overwhelmingly defeated by a young candidate who was 38 years old in the last election in 2021. His name is Robert Kyagulanyi, a.k.a. Bobi Wine. He was a very famous entertainer in Uganda and in Africa, but a very bright young man. And when he saw the despair of the people in Uganda, he decided to intervene in politics. He ran for parliament. He defeated a candidate of Museveni's ruling party overwhelmingly when he ran for parliament. And then he decided to run for president in 2021. And if people have an opportunity, watch a film, a documentary called The People's President, The Man and the Movement, Bobi Wine. It is now available on YouTube. That documentary was nominated for the Oscars at the last Oscars event. It was a runner-up. It did not win. But that documentary outlines how repressive this regime is and the danger and the risk that Bobi Wine and his supporters took to challenge this repressive regime. Essentially, it's a military regime that is semi-clothed in civilian attire, just like Mobutu had done in the Congo. Sometimes he would wear military uniform. Sometimes he would wear his colorful African attire to give the semblance that he was a Pan-African. When in fact, if people do research, they'll find out that he actually had been an agent of the CIA even before Congo won independence. I think he was recruited in 1958 as a CIA agent. And of course, Congo won independence 2 years later. So he had worked himself very closely to become a trusted colleague of Patrice Lumumba, not knowing that he was planning to kill Lumumba on behalf of imperialism. And in terms of the economy, this is the irony. The economy of Uganda has actually been somehow boosted by Museveni's Holocaust in the Congo. Because while Congolese are being massacred in their hundreds of thousands, and now estimates range from in excess of 6 million in terms of the number of Congolese that have died since 1997, as both Uganda and Rwanda have invaded multiple times. While people are being killed, people are being ethnically cleansed and chased away from their communities, the Ugandan interveners then steal the mineral resources of the Congo. And of course, Uganda does not have any major factories. Rwanda does not have any major factories either. So they export this to Europe and North America and to some Asian countries. And that is why this massacre of the Congolese is tolerated, because imperialist corporations benefit from this genocide, ongoing genocide against the people of the Congo.
How have the Congo's other neighbors responded to the genocide, countries like Angola, Zambia, as well as some of the others?
Okay, once again, thank you for that question as well. The only major intervention was in the late 1990s, heading toward the early 2000s, shortly after Mobutu had been overthrown and Laurent Kabila had become president of the Congo. And then at one time, when Laurent Kabila realized Uganda and Rwanda wanted to extend the tentacles into the Congo on behalf of Western imperialism and Western corporations, he asked them to leave. And they did not want to leave. And in fact, they launched a second war. The first war was relatively popular because it led to the overthrow of Mobutu. But the second one was a war of imperial aggression on behalf of multinational corporations by Uganda and Rwanda against the people of the Congo. At that time, Angola, principally Angola and Zimbabwe, intervened militarily and helped defeat this invasion. And that is how the government of Laurent Kabila survived. Ultimately, Kabila himself, of course, was assassinated, and it's unclear under what circumstances, apparently by some of his soldiers, but it could have been that they were the ones that were collaborating with Uganda and Rwanda as well. And his son eventually became President Joseph Kabila. And then, of course, he ran the country for several years until elections a few years ago when Félix Tshisekedi, became the president of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. So that was the only decisive intervention by Angola and Zimbabwe. But there's not been a similar intervention since that time. And as a result, Uganda and Rwanda, either directly or by supporting various militias, are able to continue the aggression in eastern Congo primarily. And the main objective is just to continue stealing the mineral wealth of the people of the Congo on behalf of Western corporations.
How are the people, the indigenous people of the Congo, affected by these mineral wars?
Terrible, terrible. In fact, I would be not surprised if many of them wish they did not have any of these minerals. They're not benefiting from the minerals. It is because of the minerals that they're experiencing the multiple invasions from Rwanda and Uganda. It is because of the minerals that millions of Congolese have been killed and expelled from their homes. Hundreds of thousands of women, as well as men, have been raped during these multiple invasions. Rape is used as a weapon of war, a weapon of terror, so that when you rape both women and men, who wants to stay around in those kind of communities?
Right.
The people of the Congo are suffering tremendously just because the rulers of Rwanda and Uganda have their eyes on the wealth of the Congo. And the wealth is phenomenal. I remember a study by the World Bank, which estimated that the value of the resources of the Congo is worth $30 trillion with a T, 30 trillion.
Wow.
That could really develop the economies of the entire East and Central African region. And that's the one that is known.
Right.
They actually could have mineral wealth worth more than $100 trillion. And that is why Belgium intervened in the late 19th century when King Leopold committed the first Holocaust in the Congo. An estimated 10 million Congolese exterminated as Belgium and the Belgian king extracted resources. They won their independence in 1960, but they never enjoyed it. Mobutu overthrew Patrice Lumumba within 3 months after they won independence, because Belgium really did not want to let go, as well as the United States, that became the partner of the Belgians in imperialism in the Congo. Since then, the Congo has not had a single day of rest because of its mineral wealth. As the late Professor John Henry Clark once said, Africa has always had all the resources that the world wants and that the world does not want to pay for. And that is the problem. Right. And that is why blood is shed.
What is the impact that the green economy, the information age, via the U.S. and Israel in the West, what kind of impact have they had on the Holocaust and genocide in the Congo?
All right, so in terms of Israel, there's an Israeli billionaire, I believe his name is Gettler, and he had signed up some very corrupt deals, I believe, with Joseph Kabila, literally taking Congo's wealth and paying literally nothing for it by bribing officials of the Congolese government. In fact, here's the irony. He was suspended and banned from doing any business, accessing any capital in the United States to continue any business there. But then he worked out a deal where they would actually release some of the ban and allow him to continue getting paid worth tens of millions of dollars, because they claim that he still had a valid contract.
Wow.
Even though it's acknowledged that the contract was obtained by bribing Congolese officials. That's how preposterous it is. In terms of the green economy, Congo, as you know, has some of the richest forests in the world. So in terms of carbon capture, Congo has everything. It has mineral resources, it has natural resources, it has enough water for hydroelectric energy that could produce electricity for the entire African continent. One of the richest countries in the world. We need for more people to understand what is going on in the Congo and the tremendous price in genocide that the people of the Congo are paying on behalf of capitalism and multinational imperialism. We need to recognize that they use fellow Africans, the rulers of Uganda and Rwanda, so that they can put an African face to this genocide. And it makes it harder to criticize, because we don't see the Europeans who are actually manipulating these African collaborators. We need to assist the Congolese in their fight against Western capitalism. They're fighting literally for their lives. Let's fight for the Congolese so that the massacres, the genocide can end, and the mass rape of Congolese men and women can also end. And I'm very glad that I've somehow contributed in any way to this discussion. And I hope this discussion is had in many other media platforms throughout the United States.
That was Milton Alamadi speaking to J.R. Bell Ray of Block Report Radio.
Earth is ghetto, I wanna leave. Can you beam me up? I'm out on the street by the corner store, you know, the one on 15th. Got a bright shirt on, so I'm easy to see. I've been down here stranded indefinitely. I can't reach my planet, but I need to leave. You should see these people, it's hard to believe how they treat each other. It's hard to conceive, oh, Earth. It's ghetto, I wanna leave, oh, Earth. It's ghetto, I wanna leave, I wanna leave. They got their hungry, starving, nothing to eat, and the homeless living out on the street, and the sick are dying, cricket police, politicians lying, criminals on the street. I got 5-volt fuel if you need it from me. I'll sit in the back if we're riding too deep. Better lock the doors, these people are stealing cheap. Roll the windows off so we can ride off in peace. Oh, Earth, it's ghetto, I wanna leave. Oh, Earth, it's ghetto, I wanna leave.
That was Alaa Sheffield, Earth is a Ghetto. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt. Despite the federal government's promise to help residents of East Palestine after the Norfolk Southern train derailment, many still lack health care and have no way to leave their contaminated homes. University of California San Diego medical professor Beatrice Golem has been leading a project on the chemical contamination of East Palestine and other catastrophic chemical disasters, including 9/11 and the Gulf War. She spoke with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
Maybe you can talk about the chemicals that were released, the vinyl chloride and the combination of these chemicals, and what potential dangers there are to those people who have been contaminated by these chemicals.
So there were a large number of different agents released. Vinyl chloride was prominent among them. Vinyl chloride has been listed as a potential terrorist threat. And when burned, it produces phosgene, which was used as a chemical warfare agent in World War I. And 3 days after the February 3rd, 2023 derailment, there was a decision to, quote, vent and burn the toxins that led to release of phosgene plus many other chemicals that are produced during such incineration events. There were also agents like dioxins, you know, referred to as forever chemicals, and furans and butyl acrylate, a good number of others. It was a car with electric vehicles, and that produces, you know, heavy metals plus the combustion products of the plastics, you know, around the wiring and the fuels and so forth. So a very large number of different agents, and I think there are many who just presume that if levels of individual agents are within safe limits, which in this case they may or may not have been, that there are no health problems. But in fact, it is both the case that many chemicals will actually impede or compete for detoxification processes with other chemicals, making each of them more higher level in the body, but also there are critical shared pathways of toxicity that transcend the nature of the specific chemical and that we showed were the basis for the chronic health problems in Gulf War illness. These include damage to the so-called mitochondria, the powerhouses of cells, and essentially every one of the East Palestine chemicals are also known to produce mitochondrial toxicity. So this mechanism is expected to add across agents, add and synergize, and can readily surpass toxic thresholds in complex chemical mixtures, even when levels of individual toxic agents are within normal limits. So that was a major source of our concern, and many of the sort of more persistent problems that people were reporting in East Palestine are a fit to the problems that we anticipate with that type of injury, a fit to what was seen, for instance, with Gulf War veterans.
What are some of those problems that people have had, health problems at the site?
So there are the symptoms that, as I say, are also seen with Gulf War illness, and then there are also health conditions that are emerging that were also reported to be elevated in Gulf War veterans. Some of the symptoms include fatigue and problems with sleep, pain problems, neurological, cognitive, and mood problems, again, very prominent in this group. Gastrointestinal problems, diarrhea was the signature gastrointestinal problem in Gulf War veterans, although gastroesophageal reflux or acid reflux was also very common. We're seeing the same here. Respiratory problems, including shortness of breath. Sinus problems, also very common in both groups. And also a range of different dermatological problems, rashes and, you know, hair loss, et cetera. There are also some highly unusual problems that were distinctive in the Gulf War, like veterans would report at many of the meetings in the public comment section that their teeth were falling apart and falling out. It was not a phenomenon that was true for most veterans, but it was true for a minority, and it was a very distinctive phenomenon. We're hearing similar reports here. And then also there are clusters of individuals sharing on Facebook problems that are known to be increased in Gulf War veterans that range from seizures to a number of people reporting having to have their gallbladder removed, heart disease, hypertension, chronic fatigue, chemical sensitivity. These are all among the problems that data show are elevated in Gulf War veterans and that are being reported. We don't know yet that they're elevated here because that character of data isn't yet available, but we certainly know that people are reporting that they are experiencing these problems, and there seem to be clusters of these problems.
When you talk about the numbers, I know that it seems like there's almost a weekly occurrence of explosions at refineries, chemical plants. It seems like there's an epidemic of these toxic releases all over the country. Is that the case?
Well, I can't really say. I mean, epidemic means more than expected, and there are a lot that occur anyway. But you're right. It is disturbing and concerning. And then we have events like the post-hurricane events where you know, flooding may occur in former Superfund sites and lead to release exposure getting into the water systems of, again, resident legacy chemicals. So there are many different ways that mixed toxic exposure events occur, and the more we can understand them in order to develop protective and treatment measures to mitigate the health devastation that commonly follows these events, the better off we are.
What happens to the residents, and I know some actually, that don't have the money to move away and are stuck in these houses that are contaminated with their children? What is the possible dangers and effects for them with these chemical toxins?
Well, many of those that are stuck there are sharing with us that they are experiencing significant health complications. And this is, you know, a tragedy. If you are the parent and are sickened and that compromises your ability, for example, to work, and some of the places that people work, actually one of them, ones that were right by Ground Zero, also closed down, then people lost the health insurance that they had. And at least one of those people is now working in another place that's right by Ground Zero with very significant health consequences, but again, without the financial resources to move. It's just heartbreaking having people, you know, I'm sick, I have sick children, I have trouble caring for them, I have trouble now having a job because of significant fatigue and weakness and GI problems and respiratory problems. And it's just heartbreaking, honestly.
Another issue has been, I believe that I've been told by residents that people are told not to talk about their illnesses. There's a pressure for denialism to say that it's not that bad. What does that do to the mental health of people and their stress when they have these symptoms and they're being told really keep quiet about them? And have you experienced any of that in your investigation?
Yeah, we've heard a lot of people talk about that, and they do report that there's bullying and that this has really torn the community apart. And again, it may be because there are legitimate economic interests on the other side, and people who are not themselves sick sometimes disbelieve people who are sick. The same thing occurred in the Gulf War, where early on the claims were it's psychogenic, meaning all in your head, or it's compensation neurosis, or it's not really real, you're not ill at elevated rates, you're just imagining it. Pretty much with every toxic exposure that we have studied, we hear people being told those things, and sadly often even from medical professionals. And in the Gulf War, certainly the evidence absolutely conclusively has shown that, yes, about a third of those that were deployed are sick attributable to their exposure, meaning they wouldn't have been sick. These are the fraction that are sick over and above the fraction that are sick in comparator groups. And actually, that third is probably an underestimate because of the so-called healthy warrior effect. The people that are deployed are the ones that are selected for being healthier. The ones that have pre-existing health problems and are likely to do worse later are the ones that are selected for not being deployed. So even in spite of that healthy warrior effect, it's about a third that develop chronic health consequences as a result of their deployment, and data that are completely, you know, cannot be questioned, including gene environment data, show that it is the chemical environmental exposure. People who have genetic impairments it's not necessarily even fair to say impairments, but who have genetic variants of detoxifying enzymes that are impaired at detoxifying a particular exposure, and then who also experience that exposure have radically higher rates of illness. And because people did not know their genetics at the time they reported their exposure and their health status, that cannot be due to factors like suggestibility or media persuasion. That is really only interpretable as a causal effect of the exposure. So in that setting, we know 100% that the exposures are tied to the health problems. Also beyond the, quote, symptoms, unquote, which are bad enough, there are the elevated rates of a good number of health problems, including heart disease, et cetera, you know, certain cancers, et cetera, that are not things that people are just experiencing in their head or making up. So this pattern where people who are not themselves affected, you know, disbelieve others, and sadly, because the medical community is often not well versed in these kinds of issues, there are some doctors that are wonderful about this and some that are not. And so doctors can unfortunately contribute to this. And we've heard from Gulf War veterans, and we're getting the same impression here, that some of the veterans told us that their biggest psychological wounds as a result of their service were not from any of the horrors that they experienced in war, but from the way they were dishonored and the way they were treated because of the illness that they experienced as a consequence of their honorable service on their return.
That was Dr. Patrice Golem, the director of a project to investigate consequences of catastrophic chemical disasters, including the train derailment in East Palestine, 9/11, and the Gulf War. On Friday, November 15th, there will be a rally at the headquarters of the Environmental Protection Agency in Washington, D.C., to call for justice for East Palestine residents. For more information, visit justiceforeastpalestineresidentsandworkers.com.
I went back to Ohio, but my city was gone. There was no train station. There was no downtown. Sometimes it disappeared. My city had been pulled down, reduced to parking spaces. Hey, oh, where to go, Ohio?
You were listening to Pretenders, My City Was Gone. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I am Akua Holt. In the wake of the 2024 presidential election, Senator Bernie Sanders slammed Democrats in a letter posted on X, formerly known as Twitter. Sanders said, quote, "It should come as no great surprise that a Democratic Party which has abandoned working class people will find that the working class has abandoned them." Journalist Roland Martin took issue with Sanders' remarks and issued a blistering rebuke to the senator from Vermont on his platform, Roland Martin Unfiltered.
Sanders' statement on the results of the 2024 presidential election. It should come as no great surprise that a Democratic Party which has abandoned working class people would find that the working class has abandoned them. First, it was the white working class, and now it is Latino and Black workers as well. While the Democratic leadership defends the status quo, the American people are angry and want change, and they're right. Today, while the very rich are doing phenomenally well, 60% of Americans live paycheck to paycheck, and we have more income and wealth inequality than ever before. Unbelievably, real inflation accounted for weekly wages for the average American worker are actually lower now than they were 50 years ago. Today, despite an explosion in technology, worker productivity, and he goes on and on and on. He goes on talking about the spending with Israel. He talked, will the big money interests and well-paid consultants who control the Democratic Party learn any real lessons from this disastrous campaign? Will they understand the pain and the political alienation that tens of millions of Americans are experiencing? And blah, 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 blah. In the coming weeks and months, those of us concerned about grassroots democracy and economic justice need to have some very serious political discussions. All right, here's why I got a problem with the statement, Lauren. He wants to throw in Latino and Black in this. No, and I said this after 16, and I said it after 20. No, Bernie, what I was just saying with Jay Elliott, you need to take your ass and go talk to white working class people. And so he keeps saying they are abandoning working class people when he wants to deny the reality of whiteness and also white culture that also drives the voting habits of working class people. How is it that Black working class folk got it, and he's wrong in his press release, Black working class people, we figured it out, but the other folk didn't?
Vice President Harris's primary message, no problem, was on abortion, was on democracy,
I got it.
No problem, was on Trump being dangerous, no problem. Her primary message was those things, but what people want to hear about is the economy and, of course, jobs.
And what I'm saying is, if you're Sanders, be specific. When I read Nyambi, Democrats ignore the working class, and I look at actual policy, that's not true. Now, if you're...
They don't message it, Roland.
Messaging...
No, Lauren.
Messaging and ignoring are two separate things.
So why are they not messaging that? They have done a lot of things. Why
and what
are
I'm
they
saying,
messaging it?
And again, what I'm saying is there's a difference between when somebody says ignore, that means you're actually doing nothing. Nyambi, when I look at actual policies, the policies are there. Now, if you're saying that that should be the primary message, it's a different conversation. And this is where Sanders gets criticized because he's constantly saying Democrats are doing nothing for the working class. And then people go, this. What is this called? Nyambi, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think part of it is just the sort of a misunderstanding. This realignment happened long before Trump got into office. He benefited off of the white working class walking away from Democrats in the 1980s. So this is not a new trend. He's not rearranged the sort of political landscape and made all these white working class voters come to him. They've been there. I think what is bothersome perhaps about the Sanders messages, it always comes back to, let's go after these people who don't show up for you and try to get them back. And what you're saying is, well, the attempts to try to get them back are still not convincing. And Lauren is saying it's the messaging. I think it's a little bit of all of those things. The white working class has found themselves angry and left behind. That's not necessarily the Democrats' fault, but they feel like it is. So they've gone to Republicans who've shown themselves anti-union, to not have been very invested in building the infrastructure in their communities, like really the Biden administration, right? Trying to ramp up infrastructure in these communities. But what they also want is a world and a life that is just not coming back. And
right.
I think that's a really hard message to take. But I think we hear this every few years from Bernie Sanders. And I think what strikes me is that what it basically says is stop talking about all this other stuff and talk about stuff that white working class men want to hear. And to do that, perhaps, I'm not saying it does, means that to do that in a way that they want to hear, you have to abandon your core base. And what Democrats are trying to do is talk about this stuff broadly and not talk about or talk to them directly. And I think that's where the misstep is, not necessarily in the policy. It's in how are they reaching out to these communities. But it's also hard to argue with racism. Jonathan Metzl's book, right. Dying of Whiteness, gets to the heart of some of this. Some of these communities that we're talking about in Ohio, in West Virginia, in Pennsylvania, and these other places are having a hard time. But part of what's happened is they voted against their economic and other interests in favor of their racial interests. And that's kind of undid these communities too. So I think it's much more complicated than talking to regular people. And whenever I hear that from Bernie Sanders, I just think you're talking about white men. Just say that. Don't talk about regular people.
Right. That's
don't talk about working class. Just say white men.
So you got to call a thing a thing. And when you keep saying, oh, they're ignoring the working class. At first it was white, now Latino and black. No, bro, a lot of these folk, they are voting for white culture. They're not voting for economic interests. When 600,000 Teamsters gets their pension saved, and Teamsters are like, yeah, no, 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 we're not going to endorse. We're not going to endorse. You don't want to endorse somebody who is part of the most pro-union at White House in more than 50 years. The woman who actually cast the tie-breaking ballot to hook y'all up. They were voting for a white man, Trump. And Sanders has to call a thing a thing.
Dad, I think it's late in the day for Bernie Sanders to change his political ideology. He's old school socialist. Race will never out Trump class. And the irony of it is, and you know, Jane Elliott's right, race is not real, except it is real in the social world. And he can't see how his whiteness has blinded him, ironically, from race. I mean, in some ways, it's the tale of two sisters. Remember when Bernie Sanders was running? And I, of course, Lauren, I mean, nobody could disagree with the fact that the Democratic Party has an establishment like the Republican Party. Well, quite different now. But they don't like those people who veer too far to the left. Bernie Sanders is independent. He caucuses with the Democrats and ran for the Democratic nomination for the same reason that I often vote with the Democrats. I don't give a damn about the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, but I do understand that one of those two parties is most beneficial for black people. And I'm thinking now about working class and the poor black people, and I agree, he's the wrong messenger. If William Barber were to say something like that, or to say it in a different kind of way and include race, then I think you could hear it different. Now, you know, but that having been said, two sisters, Breonna Joy Gray, who was working in his campaign at the top level, who in many ways understands race, but also is kind of more materialist. She's going to go with the class thing, and she's out there now, duopoly, both parties are the same, burn it all down. Okay. Nina Turner, who worked at the top of Bernie Sanders' campaign, who will integrate race differently, and she absolutely was kneecapped by the Democratic Party and Chantel Brown out there in Ohio, even as she had ran several times. The same kind of way that they had to do anything to stop Bernie Sanders from winning the nomination. Shout out to Jim Clyburn in South Carolina. But that having been said, Bernie Sanders' problem is a race problem. It has always been a race problem. Remember, Bernie Sanders was the campaign chair of the Rainbow Coalition in Vermont for Jesse Jackson. The difference between a Bernie Sanders and a Jesse Jackson is Bernie Sanders can never get off that old school, I don't care if we call you the Marxist or the Communist Party in the 1930s or 40s, race will never trump class in Bernie Sanders' world, and he keeps shooting himself in the foot on that regard, and there's nothing that can be done about this late date in the game. Maybe William Barber should sit and talk with him. Maybe they can come.
The frustration... That's it, Greg. The frustration, Greg, that I have when, and I've listened to Sanders a lot. I've listened to his long speeches in rallies, and you nailed it. He said, it's class, it's class, it's class, it's class. And I keep saying, dude, you cannot deny the reality of race. This thing goes back, when you go back to post-Reconstruction,
right,
where broke white people align with formerly enslaved people of African descent. And in every period of American history, when black people fight for rights, civil and economic rights, the quality of life for white people goes up.
Absolutely.
It was black people during Reconstruction who were elected to the South Carolina legislature that created what is known today as a publicly financed education system. Black people created that. And so what did the white plantation own? Oh, hell no. We cannot have these Negroes aligning with these white people. So what did they do? Which King talked about in his speech on the steps of the of Montgomery, of the Alabama State Capitol, when he talked about a book where he said the bourbon class, they said, sure. Guess what came in? Jim Crow. Guess what came in? Utilizing media to create a wedge between broke white people and formerly enslaved people. And that wedge that was created post-Reconstruction still exists. So in Bernie's mind, oh no, it's class. Okay, Bernie, fine. Please show me where broke white people are aligning with broke black people. And let's go down the line. Let's name right now 5 broke ass states with a lot of black people and white people. Okay, please show me, Bernie, where class in Mississippi, they're voting for Democratic policies. Show me in South Carolina. Show me in Arkansas. Show me in Louisiana. Show me in Georgia. They're not.
What William Barber talks about really is one of the messages that the Democratic Party should generally have. I mean, Bernie Sanders is not a leader in the Democratic Party, but a person like William Barber and the message that he brings should be centered. And the fact that he can't, you know, get a meeting and get the respect of the White House is shocking to me. Those are the issues you would think the party would center. And that is what we found out, I think, on Tuesday. There's so many people who are touched by those types of issues that Reverend Barber talks about. And yet he is shunned. He's not allowed to be on the stage at the White House in the Biden White House. So that makes no sense to me.
But guess what Barber does that Sanders will not do? Barber will say poor whites.
Oh, no question.
He will specify. So Barber doesn't run from race to class.
That's right.
Barber will mention race, class, and gender. Sanders has blinders on where for him, class overrules everything, and the facts simply dispute that because we know the realities of race.
That was journalist Roland Martin and guest on Roland Martin Unfiltered responding to Bernie Sanders' response to the presidential election on X. You can follow Roland Martin on IG at Roland Martin and other social media platforms. In closing, we share an excerpt from a resurfaced 2003 video in which Senator Bernie Sanders shares his views on the Republican Party's priorities and policies to high school students.
How does the Republican Party do so good? And now I'm going to tell you something that very few people in Congress would tell you. If you are the Republican leadership, and this is what your goals are, your goals are to give huge tax breaks to the very richest people in this country. Your goals are ultimately to privatize Social Security so that Wall Street can make money from that. Privatize Medicare so the insurance companies can make more money. Now, if you had an agenda like that and you went before the American people, tax breaks for the rich, destruction of Medicare, destruction of Social Security as we know it, lowering the minimum wage or abolishing it, how many votes did you think you'd get? Not a whole lot. Maybe the richest 1% would vote for you. But that's not a lot of votes. So what do I do? I've got a problem. You package it. How do you package it? And here's, I want you to pay attention to me. Because this is bad stuff. What you do is divide people up.
That was Senator Bernie Sanders speaking at C-SPAN and Comcast leadership event at Washington, D.C. Schools Without Walls High School in 2003. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Steve Zelter, Sierra Val Ray, Paulina Basilio, and myself, Akua Holt. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at Pacifica CRD. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening. Before we go, I'll leave you with this quote. If you can convince the poorest white man he's better than the best black man, he won't notice you picking his pockets. Hell, give him someone to look down on and he'll empty his pockets for you. Lyndon B. Johnson, 36th President of the United States.